I'd like to start by reiterating GCI's condolences. This is obviously a terribly tragic event for me, my family, for the company, for the state as a whole, and it's a difficult time for all of us. I think everyone in Alaska and many people elsewhere in the country are feeling a profound sense of loss. I just can't imagine how some of the families feel, but we're sitting here too, sharing that loss in many ways. I mean, these were five of our closest friends and people we've known for 20 and 30 years. And the fact that we were involved in such a tragedy is just incomprehensible to us. Dana Tindall, our senior vice president who perished, was one of the most critical people in shaping this company and helping us develop what we are. Her daughter, Corey, was bright and young and incredibly energetic. Ted has been a dear, dear personal friend for more than 30 years, and just can't imagine that he's gone. Bill Phillips was one of the first people I met when we were back in D.C. trying to keep GCI alive in spite of the efforts of the federal regulators, and he helped us explain to the senator that we really were the wave of the future, and GCI wouldn't be here today without either Bill Phillips or Ted Stevens. And then Terry Smith, the pilot, is my neighbor on Campbell Lake. I've flown with him consistently for 20 or more years. He's a mentor. He's been one of my favorite instructors, and I don't think there's a better pilot in the state of Alaska. And how he ended up dead in a plane crash is just totally beyond me. So this is a tough time for all of us. We're very, very focused right now on trying to take care of the families. The number one mission at GCI is trying to help the families, both of the survivors and of the deceased. We brought all the family members to Alaska. We're helping to house them. We're providing all the support we possibly can, and I've been spending much of my time visiting with the survivors and the family members. It's a tough week, and we obviously also have to worry about taking care of our employees here at GCI. There are 1,600 of us here, but we're still pretty close-knit, and to lose Dana and to be involved in this kind of a tragedy is something that is very, very difficult for us to comprehend. The week started out pretty well. Last Saturday, Senator Stevens and his crew came into our fishing retreat out on the Oogoolawak and joined us for what was supposed to be 4 good days of fishing. And several GCI people and our families joined the senator out there. It was a rainy, cold trip, but that's sort of been the summer up here this year. But it was very warm and very vibrant inside, and in spite of the fact that we fished less than we would have because the weather didn't always allow us to get to where we wanted to go, it was a great trip. There were a number of good poker games, there was some fine wine drunk, and there was a lot of good companionship that went on. On the morning of the crash, we elected not to fly. Terry Smith had made a run to Dillingham that morning to drop somebody off and came back and said, it's way too turbulent. People will get sick if we go up in the airplane. Let's not do anything this morning. So we spent that morning around the camp. People read. The senator was glued to his BlackBerry and delighted at the fact that we had Wi-Fi service in the middle of rural Alaska. But when Ted wasn't fishing or doing something active, he was always glued to his BlackBerry. We had a late lunch that day. Terry came back after lunch and said it looked good enough to go to the Oogoolawak, or to go to the Nushagak River where we fished kings, and 8 people went over in our turbine otter. The exact time frames involved are somewhat confused right now. I think the ones that have been released publicly are not the final, most accurate ones. We're working to help the NTSB refine and define the exact times. The relative times are correct in terms of amounts of distances, but the exact time still needs to be pinned down. Somewhere in the middle of that afternoon, the otter left the lodge with the 8 people on board plus Terry to go to the Nushagak. Shortly thereafter, my wife and I climbed in our airplane just to go on a local pleasure flight in the area. We only had a limited number of boats over on the Nushagak, so we let those folks go fish, and we'd rather fly anyway because the flying's more fun. We took off and flew probably a 60-mile circle in the area. It was windy, somewhat turbulent. the weather was extremely variable. There were places where it was 3,000 foot ceilings and 30 miles of visibility. There were places up in some of the canyons in the Togiak Mountains where it was clear. The rain was beating real hard and the visibility was extremely reduced. And the weather patterns were changing very, very rapidly. We flew, it turned out, in retrospect, within several miles of the crash site, probably shortly after it had happened, being totally unaware of it. And then after a while, we returned to the lodge. I spent the rest of that afternoon making a minor repair on my airplane. Sometime after 6 o'clock, Greg Chapados came out of the lodge and told me that when we had called the King Camp to find out what time the group was coming home so we could schedule dinner, we learned that the plane never arrived. We immediately began an assessment of what could have happened. We called Dillingham to make sure the plane wasn't there. We called several of the local air services and the local flight service station and said we had a missing airplane. My wife went and grabbed her medical gear. We hopped into my airplane and we went out to join the search. Just before I taxied into the water, I told them to notify the RCC and start the official search procedures. We were on our first pass of the search when one of the Bristol Bay Air pilots called me on the radio and said, "Hey Ron, we knew the route they would have flown," and he called me and said, "Hey Ron, I already flew the primary route offset to the south because I'm offsetting to the north." We sidestepped several miles south of the route to continue the search on the way to the Nooshigak River. 3 minutes later, he called and said, "I got him." He gave us the coordinates. We were the second airplane on site, and we called into Dillingham Flight Service with the coordinates. Tom Tucker from Tucker Air, who had been in the air in a helicopter after we called Dillingham with one of our Dillingham employees, Bob Himshoot, also heard the coordinates, and they got very quickly to the site. Tom landed and let several hundred yards above the site. Bob Himshoot got off and started to make his way down to the site. My wife saw a survivor wave and she said, "I gotta get on the ground." We landed in Alegnikik and I unloaded her in the gear from my plane. She got into the helicopter. She flew up to the site and joined Bob, and later Tom made another run and brought in some paramedics from Dillingham who were the people who spent the night on the ground. I returned to the site for 40 minutes or so, attempting to act as a radio relay between the site and Dillingham Radio. Stayed on site as long as I could. The weather started to come down fast and hard about 30 to 40 minutes later, and I was forced to leave the site and head into Dillingham. I spent the night in Dillingham attempting to coordinate the rescue coordination efforts. I should make note of our thanks and everyone's thanks for the stellar response from both the state of Alaska and the United States military. My first call when I landed was to Governor Parnell to tell him what had happened. He immediately put all of the resources of the state to help us. The Guard and General Kuznos dispatched several C-130s and several PAVOC helicopters, and the Air Force was instrumental in supporting the rescue. We had the Coast Guard come up with another helicopter. It was not until 7 o'clock the next morning that one of the helicopters was finally able to reach the site in absolutely horrendous weather conditions, and I think most of the rest is known. We didn't know who the survivors were and who the victims were until it was radioed in from the site after the second set of survivors had been loaded on. Then they called us and told us who was alive and who was dead. I think the rest is sort of pretty much out there.
So you said that these were close friends. Was this an annual event? Did the same group come out every year? Or just tell me a little bit about that history.
We've probably fished with Senator Stevens 18 of the last 20 years. It wasn't always the same group. Many of the people were the same. Bill Phillips was almost always part of the group, and Bill, who, after he left the Senator's office, worked as one of our most instrumental representatives in D.C., frequently came up independently of the Senator to fish with us. The Senator, and maybe it's more 15 of the last 20 years. There were a couple of years in there where the Senate rules got too restrictive and Ted couldn't join us for this, that, or the other reason. But during the periods when he was allowed to do so, he always brought an interesting cadre of people. Early on, before the rules got too restrictive. We had FCC chairman and others up there, and it was part of TED's annual mission to bring people from D.C. to Alaska to understand what Alaska was already always about. I remember one year that we had an FCC chairman who I think thought the wilderness was what happened when you went west of the Potomac River. And we had him on the ground in a couple of the villages around the Dillingham area. We had him in New Stoyahook. We had him in Koliganik. We had him there in a way that he got for the first time a true understanding of what was involved in trying to deliver modern telecommunications to a place that you could only access by air, where the power came from a generator on the ground, where the 200 residents were within 200 yards of each other, and the infrastructure was hard to provide. Invariably, when TED would bring federal policy members, federal policy makers to Alaska, the comprehension would go up and the results would be good for Alaska. In many ways, in my mind, it was extremely unfortunate when the federal ethics rules prohibited those sorts of trips, and then in the last few years the Senate rules prohibited the senator from even riding in private airplanes, but we lost access that we otherwise had to valuable policymakers who needed to understand Alaska. TED, throughout his career, TED used the bait of come to Alaska with me in the summer and we'll go fish and we'll do these other things to get critical people to Alaska to help them understand that this was not the world they lived in. And we were privileged to be a part of that. We met some amazing people. I still have some good friends, former senators and others. People, the experience at the Ogulawak for people who haven't been to Alaska is a once in Alaska, very much life-changing experience. You don't realize how spectacular rural Alaska can be until you've been out in a place like that. You don't realize how broad an expanse it is until you've flown in a single engine airplane at 100 knots for 2 hours and haven't seen anything else on the way. We used to take the groups down to Katmai and see the bears down there, and the enormity of the state came in on them, and we built lasting friendships as a result. And most of the people on this trip, in fact all of the people on this trip, were repeat visitors. They didn't come every year, but we knew them all and they were all good friends from prior trips.
Terry Smith's role as a pilot, was he a contract pilot? Did he work for you? How did it come to be that he was flying this plane?
Terry has worked on and off for the last 20 years as a contract pilot for us. When we first started fishing in rural Alaska, Terry flew his 185 in support of a number of our trips. He's flown with us in his Albatross a number of times. We lost our primary pilot. He quit unexpectedly early in the summer this year, and because it's difficult to find an appropriate quality replacement in the middle of the year, we elected to go with a series of contract pilots for the rest of the summer, people that we knew and had high confidence in that would be available for a couple of weeks at a time but couldn't afford to commit the whole summer. One of those was Dana's husband, Virgil Peachy, who flew with us for a couple of weeks out there. There were some others in the area who came through, and Terry had offered to come fly with us. We had the utmost confidence and faith in Terry, and obviously had flown with him many times. He had come back out after his son-in-law's death. He wanted to get away from Anchorage and away from it all. The thing Terry loved most in the world was flying, and he wanted to get away from the pain of his own personal loss and get out and fly, and he was happy to be out there.
Had he flown this particular plane in the past?
He'd had a number of hours in Otters, not as many as in the other airplanes, but he had lots of time in Beavers and lots of time in Turbine Beavers, and I don't know, it was thousands and thousands of hours of amphibious float time. I have no question that Terry was qualified in both the airplane and the area. Terry's the consummate bush pilot. He was incredibly careful, and I just cannot believe that anything will indicate that it was because he didn't know the airplane or anything like that. This isn't that kind of a crash. It it was almost instantaneous that we got approval to put Terry on the insurance, and with the numbers involved, the insurance company wouldn't have acted lightly. There just wasn't any question that Terry was qualified to fly this airplane.
How has the company been dealing with this as a whole this week? How have you been talking to employees, and how's it going?
I don't have a good sense yet for how it's going. I think an awful lot of people are still in shock, and I think the full weight of this probably won't hit us for a week or two after the funerals. There's been a lot of activity, a lot of effort. My efforts and the efforts of many of us have been providing comfort to the families of both the survivors and the victims, coordinating getting people here, coordinating their support while they're here, flying them back and forth, getting things set up to get the survivors home, helping Janet Phillips, who had to come up from the lower 48 with her family to retrieve Bill's body and her injured son, Willie, helping them with the logistics and stuff. We have endeavored to keep the employees completely in the loop. The employees have been very significantly involved in planning the event for Dana, and there's a lot of energy in that. There's sort of a sense of disbelief around the company. The company is very close-knit, and I'm confident we'll pull together. I'm confident we will survive in the long run. This is a very significant loss. The loss of Dana is very material to an awful lot of what we do. We will manage to do it successfully, but it'll be harder without Dana. And my sense is it'll be a couple of weeks or a month before we really slow down enough to realize what's happened.
Talk a little bit about Dana and her role. She was with the company for more than two decades, went through something known as the telephone wars. Can you talk a little about her role in that and how significant her work was to help the company be successful?
Dana started as an economic analyst in our regulatory department more than 20 years ago. She used to get angry when I said how much more, but recently she'd begun to accept the fact that she was no longer 21. She progressed very rapidly when the attorney who was running that department left 15, 16 years ago. She became the head of that department and continued to rise. She had good political instincts. Her training, her undergraduate training, was in economics, and she understood the core issues involved, and she was a very tenacious fighter. She believed fervently in the benefits of competition. It aligned perfectly with her academic training, and she was almost religious about the benefits of competition as opposed to monopoly. So for her, she was fighting the cause with the white hat that was the good cause, and the fact that the guys on the other side often very clearly wore the black hats and behaved very poorly only reinvigorated her sense of battle. Dana was at her finest when she was at the middle of a regulatory firefight, and people underestimated her at their peril in those events. So most of our regulatory victories she was either instrumental in or the architect of, and in the last 5 to 10 years she had really driven the entirety of the regulatory policy. I didn't have to worry about what was happening there. She'd create the strategy and she'd carry it out successfully.
You mentioned that you're planning an event. Can you tell us a little about that, and what will be public, and what do you want folks to know?
My current knowledge is that the event for Dana is at 4 o'clock on Monday, and that it will be open to the public. And it's at the Dena Center downtown. There'll be, I believe, a private funeral for Corey beforehand. Is that right, or is Corey's funeral open to the public?
We can find that out later. Yeah,
they put the obit out, and they expect a lot of folks there.
Okay.
So. Okay. Well, my last question would be, you've got employees around the state, and you've said several times that you're like a family. What do you want to say to them now?
Well, first of all, I want to thank them for their incredible support. The employees from Dillingham just pitched right in like I would have expected they would, but Bob Himshute climbing up there on the mountain in the middle of the night, sliding down the steep slope, getting so soaked he was almost hypothermic, and not thinking about himself. That's the kind of response I've come to expect from GCI. For the rest of the employees, as we go through this, I appreciate their support, and we need to know that we're all there for each other. The company will continue to go on and do good things. It will always have a large scar from a very painful wound that it's experienced, but it's not going to change who we are or the way we do business or the things we accomplish.
All right. Well, thank you so much.